Okay, so to open up here, Parshas Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim, as you know, is a jam-packed parsha in so many ways. Shlishi is just as jam-packed as the whole rest of the parsha, so I don't think we'll really have the opportunity to discuss everything that's in this aliyah, but we'll try to touch upon some of the highlights and comment on some of the points, but even that, we're not even going to have a chance to cover everything because there's so many different topics in this aliyah, so we'll just single out a few points to try to identify for some particular comments. So first, the aliyah begins talking about the Avos Nezikin, continuing the Avos Nezikin, the different categories for which one is liable for damaging somebody else's property. Of course, the link between Bava Kamma and Shabbos, if we want to look for a little synergy here. So both of them draw on the concept of Avos, both use that terminology. It's complex in both areas, but Avos seems to mean some type of general category. In the case of Bava Kamma, where we're told that there are Avos Nezikin, the first Mishnah in Bava Kamma, although the Gemara goes on to then say maybe there's more, but the position of the Mishnah initially is that there are four general categories of Nezikin. In that case, Rashi comments that Avos is a phrase that's used to mean general principles that come from the Chumash directly. Avos kari l'hanach t'ksiva b'kra. Now, as we've been discussing the past 2 days, it's not really an adequate definition for Hilchos Shabbos. In Hilchos Shabbos, the Avos are certainly not written in the Psukim explicitly. That's a point we've given a lot of focus to over these past 2 days. But in the case of Nezikin, it is a justifiable definition because the Avos Nezikin are in this week's Parsha. And this Aliyah Shlishi begins talking about the liability that one has for sure, and that one has for Eish. And the language of the Psukim, we won't go into great detail because there is great detail to be gone into and then we'll never finish, but as was pointed out, I think Shmuley pointed out, the entire Maseches Bava Kamma is really in this week's Parsha. You could really go through every daf and every line and darshan all the Psukim, so we only have the opportunity just to call attention to some major points. But there is something to be said about the general issue of Nezikin that comes out from these opening Psukim, that in general, if Parshas Mishpatim is the parsha that tells us about the liability for damages. It's a point that the Achronim struggled with, that it seems to be a little bit not what we would expect, that here the Torah tells us what we have to pay if we damage somebody else's property. But the Torah never spells out so clearly, as far as we know, that there is an isser to damage someone's property. So let's say, for example, I have my checkbook ready, and I come to your car, and I take my sledgehammer, and I say, okay, I'm going to break your windshield, and here's a check. I'll pay you on the spot. So is that mutter to do? Because I fulfilled the Torah's requirements of paying for nezikin? So the assumption is not. There are many. So that is one of the suggestions. So the Mefarshim try to figure out what exactly is the mucker. Where do you see in the Torah that it's not right to do this? And that's one of the suggestions. You have Lorecha Kamocha, others point to Derecha, Darchei Noam, but that's not a pasuk in Chumash, so that's probably not enough of a source. Rabbeinu Yonah, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, has a suggestion that's often quoted, but it's hard to have enough of an answer from that, because they refer to the fact that Rabbeinu Yonah includes within the Isser of Lo Sigzol the Isser of damaging somebody's property. So the problem with using that as an answer is that it's not so clear that that addresses what we just said. That presumably it's Lo Sigzol if you're going to cause somebody a loss. So then you can make the case that it's Lo Sigzol. And then it's still a machlokas, because there are those who define gazela specifically as causing a loss through taking something. If you're going to cause a loss but not take anything for yourself, maybe that's not gazela. Okay, so it's a chiddush to call that gazela, but maybe it's only really gazela if you're not paying for it. The scenario that the later Svarim suggested, that you're going to be ready to pay for it, let's say, is there still an isser involved? So it's not clear that Rabbeinu Yonah including it in Lo Sigzol would address that scenario. What's also a little bit mysterious about Rabbeinu Yonah is if you look at it inside, the whole quote highlights the difficulty, because he's commenting on the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The first Mishnah says, Moshe kibbol Torah miSinai, Masar liYoshua, etc. So Rebbe Yonah says over there that, yes, we're lucky that Moshe transmitted the Torah to us, because without that, we wouldn't know what was going on. If we didn't have a Torah Shebaal Peh, if we didn't have a tradition of what's in the Torah, so then reading the Pesukim wouldn't tell us everything, because there are a lot of things we wouldn't know from reading the Pesukim. For example, we wouldn't know that Lo Sigzol includes damaging somebody's property. So it's not clear how we do know it. And then, so where exactly does this come from? So the whole point still needs enough more of a support. So it doesn't seem like it's enough of an answer to the question. So there are other suggestions that are discussed. The Stipler has a piece about this in his first piece in Bava Kamma, and he says, I'll tell you right off the bat what it isn't. I said, what it isn't is Baal Tashlis. Why isn't it Baal Tashlis? Because there's two differences. That Baal Tashlis, first of all, applies to your own property equally. So if you're going to damage your own property, it's just as much of an issur of Baal Tashlis as it is if you damage somebody else's property. And secondly, Baal Tashlis is sometimes mutter, that there could be justifications for Baal Tashlis, so that's not going to be enough of a source. So I wonder if that's really also enough of an objection, that maybe actually Baal Tashlis might be a better source than Lo Sigzol, because we're only addressing half of the issue here. That we're saying that, okay, let's say I'm going to pay for the damages. So what's wrong with breaking something if I'm going to pay for the damages? What's the issue? We perceive that there must be something wrong. And indeed, there are many rayas that there's an aveira involved in damaging somebody's property. Some of the rayas are from the Saliyah as well. So if that's the case, so what is the issue? So maybe the issue is something close to Baal Tashlis, that when you break somebody's property, you're doing two things. One is you're incurring a liability towards that person. You have to pay for the monetary loss. And you're doing something wasteful. You're destroying something which is useful. So in a chanami, if you could do it to your own property, so there's nobody to pay. So that aspect wouldn't apply. But the component of Baal Tashlis may takavi what the issue is. And the Sefer HaChinuch writes that Baal Tashlis, the nature of the Isser, is that a person should not be involved in hashchasa. To be destructive is corrosive to the soul. It's not good for a person's personality. So I don't know if it's so crazy. That's not so different than saying Duracha Darcha. No, that's not. And this is a pasuk in Chumash. So I'm not so sure that that's such a terrible suggestion. But in any event, the Stipler himself prefers to see it as an issue of Hashavas Aveda, that if you have to return somebody's lost property, which we understand doesn't just mean that if you find something on the floor you have to give it back, but it also means that, let's say, you know it's about to snow, and you see that somebody left their stuff on the lawn, and it's going to get destroyed by the snow, so you have to stop it from getting destroyed. So the Stipler writes, if you have a halacha, you have to stop it from getting destroyed, so it's hard to imagine you can be the one to destroy it. So that's the source that he prefers, and there are many others. I'm not going to go into all of them now, because it was a topic really probably 2 years ago we spoke about it. But what's specifically relevant to this aliyah is that one could ask, if we could spend an hour talking about all those makoros, and then you could say, all right, so then why is it such a roundabout thing? Right? Why is it that the Torah is clear here telling us that there is a chiyuv to pay, and we have to search high and low to find the mukkar that it's also to do in the first place? Why don't we just have, in this week's parsha, have them both together, have the yisur to do it, and then if you do it, then you have to pay the same like you find by anything else. You do an aveira, the consequences that are spelled out in the same parsha. So I think the issue is that what we're trying to convey here is that it's really not the point, that the chi of nazikin is not really a consequence of yisur. It's not that, oh, you broke this, therefore you have to pay. It's a function of responsibility, which is different. It's saying that somebody has bad luck here, there's a monetary loss. So the question is it just the owner of the property who has the bad luck? Or is there somebody who bears some responsibility? They should have done something more, they should have known, or they should have taken some action to protect it. And that's what the problem is. So perhaps the Torah de-emphasizes the Isser in this context, because it's really not about the Isser. It's not about the fact that you did anything actively wrong. And in a chanami, if you're going to come with a sledgehammer, you're going to break the windshield of the car, so yeah, so you also did 10 other things wrong. And whatever it is. But as far as this week's parsha, that's not so, or as far as this section of this week's parsha, that's not so much what we're focused on. We're focused on the responsibility, which is different than the assumption that there was a maisa iser that took place. So you find some allusions to that in the phrasing of the Pesukim, that first of all, opening Pasuk and Shlishi says, Ki yaver ish sade ocherem, yishilach es bi'iro bi'ir b'stei acher, meitiv sadeh meitiv karmi yishalech. So it's a very unusual language that we're talking about letting your animal eat somebody else's field up, causing damage through what we call shame, that the ox is going to use his tooth and eat somebody's property up. So it's the ox that does the damage. So the language of ki yaver ish, that a person shall cause somebody's property to be eaten up. So the focus might be over there, as some of the Mefarshim point out, I think the Nayim Torah has a comment along these lines from Zalman Saratskin, that the idea is that even though the animal's doing it, but animals eat, that's what they do. So you know that. So as the owner, so you are responsible to make sure that doesn't happen. And therefore the liability goes back to you, just to be aware that that's the case. The Torah identifies that by focusing on the ish. Essentially, you did it, even though you didn't do it, your animal did it, but it's so predictable, this is what animals do, that that's a liability. While when I talk about negicha, when the Torah makes reference to keren, to an animal goring another animal, that's not naturally something an animal does, unless it's a shor muad, it's an animal that has a tendency to do this. But the average animal doesn't do this by its nature. It's not something that brings any hanah to the animal, as the Gemara points out in the beginning of Bava Kamma. Eating is pleasurable. Goring is not any source of benefit to the animal. So therefore, that's not as predictable. It's a liability too, but it's a different type of liability. So therefore, the Torah says, ki yigach shor, because it's the shor that does it, but you have to pay on some level depending on what the circumstances are. While when it comes to shame, when it comes to eating, which is normal, so the Torah basically says it's as if the owner did it, because the owner could have predicted this, and that's his responsibility. And you find that Shechachma has a comment along similar lines in the next pasuk, which talks about Eish, that there the language also talks about Kiseitze Eish, that fire comes out. Let's say a person sets a fire, and then the fire comes out on its own. Kiseitze Eish. So the one who sets the fire has to pay for the fire that sounds like it went on its own. It decides to go out on its own. So the truth is, again, that's what happens. Fire does move on its own once you set it, but a person has to recognize that that's what happens, and therefore there's a liability that comes for that as well. And the Meshach, sorry?
It doesn't seem like the first person talking about fire. Then talk about animals.
About it, right, doesn't sound, it sounds like a human being, right?
Like fire. I mean, yeah.
The second puzzle talking about fire.
First puzzle talking about eating. Right. I know, but it just seems like the each part. Then read the second puzzle, which is like the identical words.
Right, it sounds like the same.
Fire, being, base,
it just sounds like havara.
Yeah,
you know, that the consumption. Right, that he's talking about consuming like a beer.
You like say a shot for each, which is probably right. Mm-hmm. But like it sounds more like a person setting on a fire. That's
in the first pasuk.
Yeah.
The first pasuk is talking about eating, though. It's talking about basically consumption. But you see, it has the same kind of language, so it evokes the same type of structure of liability. That in both cases, you initially have the responsibility, and then it goes off on its own, and you had to be aware of that. So the Meshech Rachba talks about, you know, we have a phrase, Tchilaso b'shia v'sofa ba'onas. Right? There's machlokis in the Gemara that sometimes you're exempt for something that happens without your control, we call it onas. But you're liable for things that are pshia, that are negligent. So the Gemara has the machlokas, what if it's tchilaso b'pshia, v'sofa b'onas, that you do something negligent, but in the end, whatever happened wrong was an unavoidable accident. So that's a machlokas in the Gemara. But as Meshech Chachma points out, there's different levels of that, that sometimes you do something negligent, and then later on, there's an unavoidable problem that has nothing to do with your negligence. It was a function of something else. It doesn't correlate at all to your negligence. You couldn't have prevented it no matter what. So then you have a machlokas, whether we hold you liable for your shia. But here, he says you could use the phrase in a different sense, that when somebody sets a fire, so that was negligence, that was shia, and then later on, when the fire gets out of control, so then it's an onus, you can't do anything to stop it at that point. Let's say the fire has gotten too big, you can't put it out. So it's a different usage of the phrase, that there, sofa ba'onas, at the end, he couldn't stop it. But that's a different kind. Not everyone would agree you're chayiv for, because that's the kind of onus that is a direct result of the original pshia, and that's the definition of chiyuv nezikin. That's the kind of thing that you could have predicted was going to happen, and that's a liability according to everybody. So it's a similar language of tchilas of pshia to the onus. It says the machlokus is when they're two completely unrelated types of problems. But when it's like a fire getting out of control, a completely predictable onus that emanates from the original pshia, that's what all of the nezikin is about. That there's an initial pshia, and then there's a damage which maybe you don't want to do, or maybe you do want to do it. But maybe even if you didn't want that initial damage to happen, so it's still a function of your initial pshia. Then the next pasuk gets into, again, this, the topics come really fast and furious in this aliyah. So we'll see how much we can talk about. But the next pasuk introduces the concept of keifo. It says, "Ki yiten ish el reyehu kesef ochelim l'shmor v'gunav mibeis ha'ish im yimotze ha'ganav yishalem shnayim." So here in the context of Shomrim, so the Torah talks about the idea of keifo. And the notion of keifel is just interesting to note that the Rambam, we know the Rambam was an independent thinker, so the Rambam sometimes paskins against the Gemara, and you always have to figure out why he does that, but also sometimes he gives tamei hamitzvahs, he gives philosophy that's different from the Gemara, so it's just interesting. Here's an example of it. So here we have the concept of keifel, that if somebody is a ganav, if somebody steals something secretly, so he is chayev not only to return what he steals, but he has to pay twice. So it's a little bit surprising because, this, as we know, there are different types of stealing you could do. We have what we call a gazlan and a ganav. So a gazlan steals openly. And a ganav steals surreptitiously. He sneaks something out, he's a pickpocket, or he steals when no one's watching. While a ganav, a gazlan is more of a mugger. He steals openly. So the question is, why is it that the ganav gets punished more? Why is it he has to pay kefil, he has to pay twice as much, and the gazlan doesn't have to pay that? So people are familiar with Chazal, the idea that Rashi quotes from Chazal, that God is more angry at the ganav than at the gazlan. That the gazlan and the ganav both do the same thing, but the ganav is afraid of man, so he makes sure not to be seen, while the gazlan is not afraid of man, so he's definitely doing the wrong thing, but he at least doesn't have this idea that he's afraid of man and not afraid of God. The ganav is afraid of man, he's not afraid of God. So we're more offended by that. But the Rambam is a whole different theory. The Rambam basically has what you might call an economic theory of punishment. By economic, I mean the study of human incentives. And he basically understands it's not a consequence of which is worse, but it's a consequence of what do we need to do to disincentivize something. That essentially, he's assuming that the Torah needs to have a greater incentive to disincentivize Geneva than Gezela. Because a gazlan is much harder to come across, because a gazlan can't live a normal life in society, because everyone knows that he's a gazlan. So if he hangs around, he's going to be arrested. He's not going to be able to function. So most people don't want to be gazlan. But a ganav is much more tempting, because if you know a way to steal without people knowing who you are, so then you could continue to have your normal prominence, and therefore people are more likely, when it's possible, to be ganavim than to be gazlanim. So there's a greater need to disincentivize gzela than there is gneva than there is gzela. So that's why we have kefa, and that gets in also to shor v'sad, that we know that Torah says that if somebody steals an ox or a sheep and he happens to shecht it and sell it, so then he has to pay four or five times as much. And that the Gemara talks about also, about their theory as to why that is, the difference between one and the other, that the seh, you have to pay more because you have to carry it on your shoulders, it's more embarrassing. So that's the Gemara's explanation. But the Rambam, again, has a different theory which fits into this. He says when you're dealing with animals, so animals are harder to watch because you have to let them graze outside. So let's say, for example, if somebody had jewelry that was worth the same amount as his ox, so they have equal value, but the jewelry he can put in a safe in his basement that he can protect it. But the animal that's worth just as much has to graze outside. And depending on how far away from the residence they have to graze, the more exposed it is. So therefore, he says the Torah imposes this penalty of four or five times as much in recognition of the fact that the property is more vulnerable, so therefore we have to disincentivize it more. So again, it's also different from what the Gemara says. The Rambam is engaging in theories here that that are different. It's also interesting, just in terms of many, many topics that come up here. So here the Pasuk says, Mibeis Ha'ish. So the Meshech Chachma picks up on the fact that in the context of a Shomer Chinam, when you ask somebody to watch something for you as a favor, so the Torah uses the language Mibeis Ha'ish, but later on, when the Torah talks about a Shomer Sachar, somebody who's being paid, so then the Torah uses the language Me'imo, from him. So what's the difference? So the Meshech Chachma asserts that there is a difference here between the role of the Shomer Sachar and the Shomer Chinam. That it's not simply that the Shomer Chinam is doing it as a favor and the Shomer Sachar is getting paid, but it's that the role is functionally different. That the Shomer Sachar, as a function of getting paid, has to actually watch the thing, while the Shomer Chinam has a more limited responsibility. We know that he has a more limited liability. We know that what he has to pay for is reduced. He doesn't take on the same liability as somebody who's getting paid. But it's not just liability, it's responsibility, that he has to do less. So the person who's watching as a favor, all he has to do is put it in his house. He has to put it in a place where it's protected. While the Shomer Sachar has to actually work in order to protect it. So therefore, the Torah used the language Mibeso, that it's in the house of the Shomer Chinam. He's just left it in his house. While the Shomer Sachar is Me'imo, it's with him because he's actually doing something in order to make sure it stays safe. So that that impacts on other things. So, for example, as the Meshech Chachma notes, so we discussed last year in Bav Metzia the whole sugya of Poel Yachal Achzer V'Chatzi Hayom, that if somebody is a Poel, somebody is a worker, works by the hour, so he has a right always to quit in the middle of the day, he always has the right to pull out. So the Meshech Chachma says the Shomer Sachar is a Poel. The Shomer Sachar is doing something. He has the right to say, I want to stop doing it now and give it back because he is a Poel. The Shomer Chinam is not a Poel. The Shomer Chinam isn't doing anything. He's just putting it in his house, and therefore he has whatever liability corresponds to that. There is a very fascinating discussion I just saw today. It has to do a little bit with the state of contemporary Jewish jurisprudence. That here there's, again, all of Masechet Sanhedrin and Bava Kamma to say, so we're not going to go into so many details. But if you look at Pasuk Ches, so it says, Al kol dvar pesha, al shor, al chamor, al seh, al salma, al kol aveda, asher yomar ki huzeh. Remember from last year, ki huzeh is the mucker that the Gemara quotes for the chiyuv of modeh b'miktzas, that if somebody is kofar hakol, if somebody denies a debt completely, so then we say hamotzi mechaver lo harai, the other guy has to prove that he owes him anything. But if you admit to half of it, so then you have to take a shvuah. So the Gemara quotes this pasuk, ki huzeh, is a whole discussion of what exactly is the nature of that derivation. That's also a big topic. But then the pasuk goes on to say, ad ha Elohim yavod dvar shnehem asher yashin Elohim yishalim shnayim l'riyehu. So the word Elohim here is chol, it's not kodesh, you don't have to say Elohim, it's talking about human beings. This is a reference, the Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin tells us that this means judges. And so there's a panel of a Sanhedrin of Bezdin, rather, of three judges. That's what's referred to in this pasuk. So the Mechilta, talking about the fact that this is a reference to judges, so the Mechilta has an interesting statement, which I saw an interesting machlokas about just this morning, that the Mechilta says, how do you know that a dayan, that a judge, should not have sanigorin? How do you know that? You know that from this pasuk. So what does sanigorin mean? Right, we know the expression, what does sanigorin, sorry? Eidim? Probably something a little more than Eidim, relates similar, but it would mean more closer to, in a modern context, attorneys. Sorry? I didn't hear what you said. Or in this case, or defense attorneys, really, right? In Kategor, not Sasanegor. So we normally say that the prosecutor can't become a defense attorney. So there's a Mechilta that says, Sanegor, that same word, that judges should not appoint Sanegorim because of the pasuk of Ad Ha Elohim. So what does that mean? What exactly is the nature of that issue? So the Torah Tamima in this pasuk, the Torah Tamima has a whole discussion that he says, this means that it's not right in the Bezdin. A Bezdin shouldn't work like a secular court. In a secular court, you have advocates on your behalf, you have an attorney, And in a Beis Din, you shouldn't have that. You shouldn't have somebody who's going to intervene between the litigants and the judges. You should just have ad ha'elohim, again, that the litigants should speak directly to the judges. They shouldn't have anybody in between.
Isn't that in the Mishnah
Perkei Avos? Yes, Al-Tas Asmuk Archei HaDayanim, that's you're referring to. So I'll mention that in a second. So it's interesting. So this is a very controversial topic today. Because nowadays, in contemporary Bat Dei Din, so many of them have the practice of having tohanim, having hired people who come in and argue on behalf of their clients. And not everyone is so into that whole idea. Rav Schechter gave an interview some months ago where he talked about how that leads to a lot of corruption. And in the Beis Din of America, which somewhat associated with our yeshiva, so the Beis Din of America highly discourages or outright bans the use of tohanim. Does not think that this is consistent with justice. And Rav Schechter often comments that he thinks that part of the whole role of dayanim, that you know, we now have, you learn choshen mishpat, so you have all these klolim, you have all these formulas you can plug in. Okay, someone says this guy says that, pater, chayiv, shvur. So you might say, so where do the dayanim come in? They could just plug in the computer, plug in the formula, and say, okay, time is this, you do that, time is this, you do that. So if you ever read any gedolim stories about the dayanim, so you always have all these fancy Encyclopedia Brown stories where they unmask the liar by, you know, putting a piece of paper on a door with some talcum powder, whatever it is, it has some kind of a trick.
So,
yeah, cut the baby in half, right? So where does all, that's an important discussion also, right? Where does that all fit into the rules? So the answer is that those rules kick in when the dayanim don't know what the story is. But the dayanim's responsibility is first to try to figure out who's telling the truth and who's lying, to figure out who's a rabbi, who's honest and who isn't. And then, when all else is equal, if you can't determine things any further, so then you have these klalim as to decide what the policy is going to be. But if the Beis Din can figure out that one guy's not telling the truth, so then that changes things. So, therefore, as Schechter has commented, that he thinks it's not right for there to be an intervening person. You know, you have to be listening to litigants themselves say what they're saying and figure out if they're telling the truth. So to have a hired person who doesn't really know, maybe doesn't know what's true or not, and is going to express these claims on behalf of the other person, they don't think that's right. The Gemara talks about tonin. But the Gemara means in terms of providing timeness for people. You have to advise sometimes people what their legal rights are, which is different than somebody arguing on their behalf and saying their positions. So the Torah Tamimah has a whole speech in this morning's Parsha, in this Pasuk, where he says that's what this means. He says it means that the Al Yamid Sanigarim, that the Dayanim should not allow there to be people who are in between the litigants and him. That they should, he should just say, Ad Elohim, that the litigant should speak directly to the judges. So then he goes on to kind of weaken his point. He notes that there are other interpretations, but he thinks it all means the same thing. He says that there is a Gemara in Shavuos and Daf Lamed, that the Gemara says that a Dayan should not have Sanigarin, and that connects it to the Pasuk of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So there, Rashi and the Rambam interpret it in different ways than what he just said. So Rashi says it means that the Dayan shouldn't say, the Dayan has a position that he's tending towards. But he's not so sure it's right. So psychologically, what's he going to do if he's not sure it's right? So he's going to try to support it kind of externally without really acknowledging the fact that it might be wrong. So that's not a process to the truth. The Dayan should acknowledge that he might be wrong, or that he is wrong, instead of trying to buttress up his point that is not actually accurate. That's the way Rashi understands it. It's a psychological insight. So he shouldn't bring in other advocates, so to speak, as far as, not necessarily people. He shouldn't bring in other ways to try to buttress as far, which may not actually be true in this case. While the Rambam understands it differently, the Rambam means that he shouldn't say things to support one of the litigants, that he shouldn't be a sanegor on behalf of one of the litigants, and start to advocate things that support him, which I think also highlights a very important point. It's mentioned this in a different context recently, that we have a pasuk, B'tzedek Tishpot Amisacha, which the most famous interpretation of Mishnah Perkei Avos, the Gemara in Shabbos actually, says that it means, Havidanis Kol Adam L'chavzchos, should judge people favorably. But one of the interpretations Chazal also have is that a Dayan, who's judging people, has to judge B'tzedek, means that he shouldn't let one side talk for a long time and the other side he cuts off 2 minutes in. Or one side he's smiling at and the other side he's frowning at. So he assumed that there's really two things going on that are bad. One is you may have actual injustice because one side gets to say its view and the other side doesn't have equal opportunity. But even if the judge is going to really evaluate both sides equally, but he's going to give one side the perception that he's getting favorable treatment and the other one not, that's going to create an imbalance, which also could pervert the day. So even if the judge thinks, okay, I'm cutting off the guy I like because I want to look balanced or whatever, I don't want to tip my hand or whatever it is, but the litigants are going to think that the other guy gets to speak and I don't, or vice versa, or the other litigant's going to think I have an edge here because he likes me, and the other guy is going to lose, that itself will affect the nature of the proceedings. So presumably that's what you see here also, what the Rambam is saying, is that if he's going to support something that one litigant is going to say, and then even if when he actually passes, he's going to pass against that litigant, but the effect that will have on the environment is going to unsettle things, and that's perhaps what this is getting at. So in that context, it has Midvar Sheker Tirchak really as the makor. That Gemara is talking about the pasuk later in the parasha of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So the Taras Bima thinks that really it's all in line with this idea, and he notes that there's another girsa on the Gemara that says Al Yamid Sanigorin. So he thinks it means the same thing. Like he says, you shouldn't have advocates in between because that will also take away from the emes. That will also create an environment of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So my grandfather has a commentary in the Torah Tamima called the Meshivas Nefesh. It's published in the bottom of the newer editions. So he has a discussion there. He doesn't think this is true. He thinks that he doesn't see an Isra here of Tonin from this Mechilta, from this Medrash. He thinks the Pshat is like Rashi and the Rambam. But he says also, if you believe that that's an issue, so he discusses, how come, like you asked, why doesn't the Torah Tamima also make reference to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which is explicit? That the Mishnah says pretty much straight out that a judge should not do things which puts him in an advocate's role, and that's something to consider. So that's a fascinating machlokas, and again, that's something that's very relevant to contemporary Jewish jurisprudence. The whole question of the viability and the appropriateness of Tohanim, and what does it do to affect the justice systems? That's a contemporary machlokas, which may or may not be a subject of discussion in the Saliyah. So then, to skip around a little bit again, because there's just too much here, there's quite a lot to say, but in Pasuk Yud Gimel here, so the Torah has the fascinating din, which the 8th parak of Bamitzia is about, the din of Baila Vimo. Very hard idea to understand. That normally, if I borrow your property, so if I let it get damaged, if all the rules fit, I'm going to have to pay for it. But if I borrow your animal and something happens to the animal, I'm going to have to pay for it. But if the Torah says that's only if ein baila vimo, that if the owner is not actually with you. But what if I not only borrowed your animal, I borrowed you too? I got you to do work for me. So if you're working for me, and I have your stuff, if I break your stuff, or your stuff breaks under my watch, rather, I am pater. Very hard to understand. Sorry?
Can you say that again?
Yeah, the din is a very non-intuitive din, that if the person who owns the property that I borrowed him too, so to speak, I got him to work for me, so then I'm pater. I'm pater to pay for the damages. Very hard idea to understand. And it would seem like he loses out for doing me two favors. Does me one favor, then he gets covered if something happens. But if he also himself works for me, so now I'm pater. So what's that about? Chavis Yar is a tshuva trying to figure. It's hard to see how this comports with our sense of yashrus. Why should it be that all of a sudden you're not liable for that? So Tosfos in Bava Metzia, Tosfos says it's exeris hakasev, and it doesn't have a svara that we understand. It's an exemption from the pasuk, and we don't understand why this is. But even if something's exeris hakasev, I don't know if that means that we can't try to figure out what it's about. So there are a few views in the Rishonim to try to explain what they think the svara is. Any one of the views is vulnerable to various questions, because the whole parak above Metzia talks about all the details, so the details are not necessarily going to match any one of these theories fully. You have to figure out how it matches. In some cases, it might say, low plug. Hi.
But Rashi there says, like, even if it wasn't working with you, I think.
Right, so that's the problem also. Some of the details are going to be harder if he was with you when you hired him. Like, if at the time when you borrow the property, you also hired him, so then if he wasn't working with you when it broke,
Yes.
Right. So that's going to be a problem for some of these theories. So if you listen to theory, you have to figure out which ones work and which ones don't work. So, or which ones work for all the details. None of them work for all the details. But just to mention some of the theories that are out there. So the Sforno says that what's going on here is that we're talking about a shoel. A person borrows the property for his own benefit. So the lender, we see from the context, the fact that he's also lending himself, he's also giving himself to work, that shows that there's a very close relationship between the people. And that therefore, it tells us that the nature of the loan, the nature of the lending, not loan, the nature of the lending of this item was done not in a standard way, but was done really as a gift to this guy. If they're so close, they're so friendly, so when he lent him his object, he really gave it to him as a gift. And the condition was that, listen, when you're finished with it, if it's in good shape, I want it back. But if it's not in good shape, I'm out. That's basically the understanding, that we're so close that I'm willing to work for you too. So I'm giving you this animal to have, really, but if by the time this is over, the animal's still in good shape, I want it back, otherwise not. So the problem is this applies to other levels of Shmira also, so then apparently you'd have to say lo plug, that this is really about She'ela, but the Torah extended it as a desire not to distinguish. There's a safer, contemporary safer called Minchas Aharon. There's a nice discussion about this. So you suggest, according to the Sforno, you have to say like that, that it's a lo plug. The Sefer Achinuch has a different theory. The Sefer Achinuch says that you have to say it like this, that since the guy is with the property, normally somebody borrows something, so I'll take your animal and I'll put it in my house, and the owner is separated from it. But if I take both of you at the same time, I have the property and the owner, so then the owner should keep an eye on it. So if something happened to it while the owner is there, so then that lets the borrower off the hook, which is a fascinating theory. It basically says that the whole liability here really comes in two parts. That the shoel takes on the agreement of borrowing it and returning it and the like, but the liability for preventing other damage from happening is a function of the fact that it's in his property separated from the owner. That's apparently what the Sefer Achinuch is saying. But if the owner is there too, so then that mitigates his responsibility. Now that's a problem for your Rashi, as Sefer Achinuch acknowledges, but he says, so if that's really true, so then it should only apply if the owner is there when whatever damage happens. Now, if the owner is not there then, and if the halacha is explicitly not that way, that if they're both contracted at the same time, but he's not working for him when the damage happens, so then that's not an exemption. I mean, that is still an exemption, so you have to figure out how that works. So the Chinuch acknowledges that, and he says, again, something similar. You have to say that since we can't dictate every minute, so we have to have some point that establishes the relationship, and that'll be at that initial moment, and even if he's not actually there, when the damage is all a flow out from that original contracting. Okay. The Ralbag has a fascinating comment here, which I have to figure out what exactly are the psychological implications and what exactly it says about other types of relationships. But the Ralbag says the reason there's a patur here is he says you cannot be an Eved and an Adon at the same time. Meaning what? That if this owner of the property is going to be working for the borrower, so he'll be, so to speak, an Eved to him. He'll be subservient to the guy he's working for. But he'll also be an Adon over him, that he holds control over property the guy's using, and he is ultimately the one who'll get paid if something happens. So it's two contradictory roles, that he's both an Eved and Adon at the same time, coming from the same transaction. So that's why it's a problem. It's a fascinating idea. It's a big chiddush. You have to figure out what exactly are its implications for life in other contexts. But all of these are fascinating theories about the very unique din that you find here in the Torah, and each one is going to have problems with the details. We'll have to figure out if it works out or not.
What kind do you view them as shutfin?
As shutfin, if they shutfin basically have equal responsibilities towards each other, they may have a division of labor, but this nature that one person is in charge of the other for this purpose, and at the same time the other guy is in charge of him. Because they're not shutfin. That's the nature of the idea, is that he's working for the other guy. So if that's the case, he has this notion that therefore it's
working with him.
is working for him. And the truth is, you can ask the question the other way, right? If you're saying that it's about being, let's say, the Sefer Achinuch's point, that it's about being present, so then Shutfin should have the same din. So that's part of the problem with all these theories. You have to make all the details work out. But I think if we were talking about Shutfin, normally Shutfin would have similar responsibilities. But it is interesting, let's say, if you want to consider a model like the American government, where you have a separation of powers, where, you know, for some things one person is in charge and another things another person is in charge, and it's davka broken up, you know, is that at all similar to what the Ralbag is talking about? I guess not necessarily, because he's talking about the really inverse thing happening at the same time, but it's definitely a interesting idea. So there's a lot more on this parsha, just to quickly head towards the end before we run out of time. So towards the end of the Aliyah, there's a very important idea. There's a lot to say about it. Okay, we'll talk it quickly. That Torah talks about in Kesef Talves Amin, that if you shall lend money to someone. So despite the fact that it sounds like it's conditional, that if you should happen to do this, our understanding is that this is actually a mitzvah. That's the way Chazal read it, that this is a language of you should, not just a language of if, and there's a whole discussion. It's a beautiful sefer called Ish L'Re'ehu, which talks about Ben Adam Mochaber topics in the parsha. So he has a whole discussion, why would it be that Torah would use the language him if it really means you must? But in any event, that's the way Chazal understand it, that you must help somebody out with a loan. And it's a fascinating idea. This is an underappreciated mitzvah, because this is considered to be one of the primary expressions of chesed that we have. Now, we talk about chesed, I ask you to give an example of chesed, so you'll think Bikur Cholim, something like that. There are other more famous examples of chesed. But in Chazal, lending money is high up on the lists of chesedim, and it often represents the whole realm. The act of chesed that we have for people is to provide them with financial assistance. And this is considered to be like an act of tzedakah. But it's interesting in terms of the role of chesed. So, for example, the Chafetz Chaim has a classic sefer on chesed called Avos Chesed. So if you read the sefer, about half of it is about this. About half of the Avos Chesed is about lending money to people. There's a less well-known contemporary sefer called Mitzvah HaChesed, which sounds like it's got a broad subject, and the whole sefer is about lending money to people. So that's a little more surprising, but the Avos Chesed, again, more classical sefer, so such a huge chunk of it is about this. This is really considered to be representative of Chesed, and it's considered to be a tzedakah as well. We normally distinguish between Chesed Shebegufo or Chesed Shebemono, that tzedakah is called Chesed Shebemono. You help people out with your financial resources. And other types of chesedim, where you provide your time to people, so that's called chesed shebegufo. It's normally two categories, a lot of parallels, a lot of overlapping between them. But they're considered to be these two parallel categories. Here, it's considered to be a tzedakah, no less. The fact that you're going to get the money back, hopefully, when you lend the money, you're going to get it back. So we don't consider that to be any less of a tzedakah than when you give money that you don't expect to get back, because we know that money has use. And property, we'll talk about in a minute, so it has people charge for renting property. There's a value to temporarily holding property. So if you provide your money to somebody or you provide your property to someone, even if you ultimately take it back, but the time that you provided it for, you're giving up use that you could have and giving it to somebody else. So that's called tzedakah, no less than any other types of tzedakah. So this is part of a mitzvah which repeats itself many times in the Torah in different forms. So, for example, in Parshas Bahar, so the Torah tells us that if your friend starts to falter, you see that somebody is in financial trouble, somebody is in bad straits financially, doesn't have enough to keep going. So then the Torah says, you have to support him, and that certainly means including loans. The Rambam understands that to be a mitzvah tzedakah. The Ramban sees it as a broader life support type issues, but it certainly includes helping them out with a loan. And we also find it's relevant this year, so we're coming up on a Shemitah year. I haven't talked about that too much, but we're coming up on a Shemitah year. So the Torah is very explicit in that context, that Shemitah brings with it Shemitah's Ksafim, that loans will be canceled. So the Torah expresses a great concern that somebody might think that, okay, Shemitah year is coming, and loans are going to be canceled, so maybe I don't want to lend money to anybody because of that. So the Torah considers that, calls that person Belial, a person is a sinner, a person is a scoundrel, somebody who would think like that. So what do you mean it's a sinner? You don't have to lend money. So apparently you do. Apparently that's considered to be a big responsibility, and that if somebody's going to take this attitude that I'm not going to lend because Shemitah is too close and it's not going to last, so then that's considered to be very negative in the Torah, and that's also a part of the thinking. Sometimes people say, oh, look at Hillel, he worked around the Torah by instituting Prizbul. And it's not really the case. So the Gemara says that when Hillel instituted Prizbul, it's because Shemitah at that time was Drabbanan. It was a whole part of the system. But that point aside, Hillel was working with the Psukim, that the Torah says that we have to make sure that Shlotin Odelos Bifnei Lovin, that we shouldn't have a situation where people aren't going to want to lend money. That's explicitly built into the Psukim, that you have to make sure to, on the one hand, provide this benefit of Shemitah's Ksafim, but at the same time, if that's going to result in people not lending money, that's going to be a very serious problem. So we find that this exists in the context of money. It probably exists in the context of property also. It's interesting, in English we have different words. In English we have the same word for both. You borrow money and you borrow property. You lend money and you lend property. In Hebrew we use different language and there are halachic differences between them, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in Hebrew we talk about halva for lending money, and she'ela is borrowing property. And in addition to the halachic differences, but halva basically means that you're going to spend what you have. You're going to consume the resource that you're given, and you have to pay back the equivalent value. While she'ela means you're going to give back the same item you get. Somebody lends you a sefer, you'll give back that same sefer. Somebody lends you $10, you'll spend the $10, and you'll give back a different $10. But it seems like they're both mitzvos, they're both acts of chesed, and you find that elsewhere in the Torah as well, so in Parshas Kedoshim, so the Torah says you're not allowed to take revenge, l'sikom v'l'sitor. So what exactly is the scope of not taking revenge? So it's much more mundane than it sounds. The Gemara says that it means that if somebody doesn't want to lend you property, you shouldn't say, I'm not going to lend you property because you didn't lend me property. And don't bear a grudge, l'sitor, that means that if you do lend the property, but you say, yeah, I'll lend it to you because I'm not a jerk like you, so that's called material. So that's the whole context. It's a little bit surprising. So some understand, the Sefer Yoreim has an understanding over there. The Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch say it's really talking about all kinds of revenge. This is just an example the Gemara gives. It's a whole discussion. But here the Sefer Yoreim says that, no, it's Davka there, because what that Pasuk is getting at, it's together with Yahav Lorecha Kamoch and Parshas Kedoshim, which is the mandate of Chesed in general. And Chesed includes lending property out to people who need it. So you shouldn't think, okay, I'm only going to do this if he did it for me. If he lent me property, I'll lend him. But if he didn't, he doesn't deserve it. So that's what the Torah says. No, losiko velositor. This is a basic chesed you're responsible to do. And it's not right for you to say that I'm not going to do it for people who didn't do it for me. So that also, again, reflects this idea. And we also know Chazal say that it's a Gemara in Yuma. If anybody's learning Daf Yomi, Daf Yomi is at the end of Yuma now. The Gemara in the beginning of Yuma says that the idea of a bayis hamanuga, that if somebody's house contracts saras, so one of the things that'll happen, different punishments for different types of failings. So if somebody refused to lend property to people and said, oh, you need a lawnmower? I don't have a lawnmower. You need a DVD player? I don't have one of those. But then when his bias is afflicted with saras, he's going to have to take all his property and bring it outside, and everyone will see, oh, there's the lawnmower he said he didn't have. You know, there's the coffee maker he said he didn't have. And so it's going to be a big resilient to him. He'll be exposed to somebody who refused to lend property when he could have. So again, this reflects the idea that it seems like there's a mitzvah not only to help out with money, but to help out with property, when that's going to make a difference as well. So they ask that the Ran sounds not like this, because the Ran in his Tshuvas in Siman Yutes, the Ran has a statement that if you're going to lend somebody a religious item, if you lend somebody a sefer, or you lend somebody tefillin, so that's a mitzvah, because you will be considered helping in his mitzvah, you're participating in the mitzvah. So he says, therefore, it's a very technical point, he says, Ksos talks about this, he says, normally we say a shoel, like we're talking about today, somebody's borrowing, We normally say he has all the liability because kol hanah shelo, he gets all the benefit. There's nothing going back to the lender, and here the borrower gets everything. He doesn't have to pay for it. He gets to use it. He gets all the benefit. So the Ran says that's not true if the lender is lending a mitzvah item, because he also gets a mitzvah for doing it. So some say, okay, you see from the Ran that there isn't.
What does he become?
Sorry?
So what does the borrower, what is the...
So it's like he become, it's a good question. I have to figure out exactly what it is. There's a little bit more of like a socher, if he's paying for it, or I have to figure exactly what the status is, a whole discussion of the tzos and the like. But the essence seems to be, sounds like he's saying that there's a mitzvah if it's a mitzvah item, but if it's a coffee maker, maybe there is no such mitzvah. That's how some read the Ran. Others say, no, that's not what he means. Some agree that that's what he means. And they say that maybe, Taka, there is no mitzvah in the sense that there's no chiyuv. Yeah, we talk about money, so then we said it means you have to, that there's a chiyuv to help people out with financial assistance when you can. But when we talk about property, that's not a chiyuv. It's a nice thing to do, but it's not a chiyuv. So the Shloah says, because property depreciates. So if you're going to lend the property could end up being damaged in his hands, and then you will actually have to suffer for that, so we don't obligate you to suffer for it. But when it comes to money, so the money will always have the same value. So if you lend him $10, he pays you back $10, it'll always be the same. But you lend him your treasured heirloom safer, and then he ends up damaging it, so then you're going to have to take a loss. You're not obligated to do that. And along similar lines, the Emre Yosher, Rav Meir Arik, and his Shuvah Emre Yosher, he says that money you can guarantee, you can have collateral, which we'll talk about for a second, we'll talk about in a second. You can have collateral for money, and you can't have really collateral for property, because it can only represent the value, but it can't represent the item itself, and maybe you don't want to give that up. So that's possible. The contemporary sefer called the Kodesh Yisrael, very beautiful sefer, and Yana Ben Adam B'Chaveiro, so he says, no, the Ran just means that it all depends. That you know that there's some types of lending that's a chesed and sometimes isn't. That sometimes somebody borrows your video game machine. So okay, so there's no real mitzvah involved in letting him use your video game machine. He's happy, fine, it's nice. But sometimes a person really needs something that's really going to make a difference to his life. It's an item that's really going to help him. And then it's a real chesed. So clearly there are times when it actually is a chesed, and there are times when it's something less. And the Ran just addresses the fact that it's not always a mitzvah per se, but sometimes it definitely is a mitzvah. A mitzvah in the same sense as what this pasuk is talking about in terms of lending money. So the Chafetz Chaim and his Avos Chesed, again, so much of it is about lending money. So it's not really clear how to put a quantification on this mitzvah. But when it comes to tzedakah, so tzedakah, the Gemara says in Ksubis that there's a limit, that we recommend a person gives a minimum of meiser, to give 10%, but that's not an explicit Gemara, that's probably more of a minig. But there is a Gemara, it sounds like it's an Issa de Rabbana, and the Gemara says it was a takana, they made an usha, that one should not give more than 20% of his money to tzedakah, because he may become impoverished. So the Chafetz Chaim says he's not sure whether or not to apply that to lending money, because on the one hand it's an act of tzedakah, we should maybe have the same...
Robert,
lending money he's talking about first. He says, so should we say, okay, lending money is the same minimum, the same shear as giving money? It's not, you give money straight out, we have a 20% limit. So if you're lending it, is there also a limit? So it's hard to say it should be the same limit, because if you're going to get it back, you won't become impoverished. But on the other hand, you know, you still may need the money to function. So you have to just assume that whatever a person is capable of doing, a person has money that he's able to lend, so then he's chayiv to help out. And if he doesn't, then he's not. It's not just simply have to be measured that way. But together in this din, so the pasuk that we just see here has a fascinating halacha together with it, that the Torah says that in kesef dalei you have to lend lo siach chenosha, that a person should not be like a creditor. He shouldn't act like a creditor. So what exactly does that mean, not to act like a creditor? So the Gemara says that one is not supposed to pressure the person who borrowed the money. You shouldn't pressure him to pay it back. And the Gemara seems to, Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Ayin Hei, seems to have a pretty extreme version of this, where the Gemara says that you shouldn't even indirect pressure, which means, let's say, for example, if you're going to hang around the guy and you don't normally hang around him, you're going to start walking past him all the time, and you don't normally do that, and you know that walking past him is going to remind him that he owes you money, and he's going to feel tense because of that. The Gemara says that's included in this issa, that that's like acting like a creditor. You're pressuring the guy to pay you back. So that's a discussion whether what the Gemara talks about walking in front of him, is that the Isser Deraisa that we just read here, or is that the Nisa Derabanan, and maybe the Isser Deraisa is only when you're doing it on purpose? It seems to be that there has to be some type of intent that's involved. But still, the parameters are subject to machlokas. The Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, they write that this means only when you know the guy can't pay you back. Right? Because you have a right to be repaid. So if somebody borrowed money and he's not paying you back, so why shouldn't you ask him to pay you back? So the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch say that in English we talk about a creditor, anybody who you owe money to. But here, with this usage of nosha as a creditor seems to mean somebody who's just being irritating, who's just being oppressive, because the guy is not in a position to pay back. So if you know the guy can't pay you back, so the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch says that's what the Torah is talking about here. When you know the guy can't pay you back, to still pressure him to pay you back, that's the violation of this isser of not being like a notion, not being like a creditor. So Minchas Chinuch has a question here. You have to figure out how much of a question this is. Minchas Chinuch says, but only if you know. So if you don't know, then what? If you don't know, so you should say, it's a safek isser deraisa, a safek l'chumra. Right? So if you say it's only usser when you know, so if you don't know, it's a safek. You shouldn't be able to ask if you don't know either. So he responds that if you're going to have such a limit, then no one will ever be able to collect debts, because no one knows for sure what somebody's story is. Even if you think somebody is able to pay, you may have other obligations you're not aware of. So you never know for sure that he can pay. You might know for sure that he can't pay, but you never know for sure that he can. So if you're going to say that even a suffix is included, then you could never ask for your money back, and that's hard to believe. You could also say that it's not an application of suffix deraisa l'chumra when the whole nature of the isser is only in this scenario. But if the isser is defined by asking for money that you know he doesn't have, so then that's not something that really lends itself to suffix l'chumra. But okay, it's a question that Chassidus raises. Rabbi Avram Price was a Talmud of the Avnei Nezer, the author of the Eglei Tal. So he passed away not so long ago. He was a Rav in Toronto. So he wrote the commentaries on the Smag and a few other Svarim like that called Mishnah Sovram. So he writes that he thinks it depends on the circumstances. That there's two types of loans. That in general, if you know the guy can't pay you back, so that's a problem no matter what. But the more expansive isser, so it depends. There's two types of loans. Sometimes you loan somebody money and you expect fully to get it back. That's the terms. You're lending it and you're supposed to get it back. And sometimes you loan in kind of a stucco sense, meaning that you're going to give him the money and you call it a loan and you hope he'll pay you back. But you also know that he's in bad financial circumstances and it's very likely he's never going to pay you back. And in your mind, then you accept that you may never get it back. If he pays you back, good. But if he doesn't pay you back, it's not going to be such a surprise. So the Mishnah of Rum says in that case, where it's really a stucco kind of loan, so then we have a very broad example of what nosha means. You can't be direct, indirect. If you don't know, no matter what it is, you can't put any kind of pressure on it. But when it's a loan that the terms are you really do expect to get it back, so then the isser is only like the Rambam and the Chinuch say, when you know he can't pay it back, to pressure him anyway, so then that's a problem. But the other more expansive versions don't necessarily kick into that. It's also fascinating that the next pasuk talks about a collateral, that if you take collateral from somebody, so you have to give it back to them when they need it. So that seems to put the focus on returning the collateral. But what's fascinating is, it emerges from some of the halachic sources, that there is a mitzvah to take a mashkel, a mitzvah to take collateral. Which is a fascinating idea, right? You think that a lender lends money, and he takes collateral for his own benefit. He wants to be protected. And I should emphasize here that when we talk about a mitzvah of lending money, so everyone agrees that the mitzvah is there when you're able to, meaning that you have the funds available and you also can expect to get them back. But if you don't trust the person, if you don't think you're able to get it back, so then you don't have a mitzvah to throw your money away. That if you don't think you're going to have faith in the person to return it, so the mitzvah doesn't apply. But a factor of this is that not only are you allowed to take a guarantee, you're allowed to take a mashkon, but there are makoros that indicate that it's actually a mitzvah to take a mashkon. Because we find, for example, that somebody who's watching lost property, a shomer aveda, is sometimes pater from other mitzvos, and we call him a shomer sachar, the Gemara says, in Hakones. So as the Ketzos and others discuss, you find the same halacha by somebody who's watching somebody else's stuff, not because he found it, but because it's a mashkon, because he lent them property, he lent the money, and he's holding onto their property as collateral. So it sounds like he's doing a mitzvah now with their mashkon, just like the Shomer Aveda is doing a mitzvah by watching somebody's property before he can return it. So too, the guy who's holding on to a mashkon is also doing a mitzvah. So the Rishonim talk about how could that be a mitzvah? What exactly is the mitzvah in protecting yourself by taking a mashkon? How is that a mitzvah? So Tosfos, in the Gemara above Metzia, the Rishonim will talk about this. So Tosfos says that it's a mitzvah because you wouldn't loan otherwise. So this is a part of what makes the loan possible, since lending money is a mitzvah, and you're only going to be able to do it if you're guaranteed, because you don't want to throw your money away. So then it becomes a chelek of the mitzvah. So just like the loan itself is a mitzvah, so holding on to the mashkon is itself a mitzvah. Other Rishonim go a little bit further, like the Ritva and the Rashba write, that it's a mitzvah of a loan, but it's also, now you have to work. If you just lend somebody money, you don't have to do anything. You just give them the money and forget about it. Or don't forget about it, but you just give them money and you wait for it to come back. Well, if you're going to take the mashkon, so now you got to protect it, and if it's an animal, you got to feed it, we got to keep it in good shape. So now you're doing the chesed of lending, but you're also taking on tircha for yourself to do that. So that's what makes it into more of a mitzvah. And the Ravid points out along similar lines that it would be easier to, if you didn't really care about the guy's happiness, you could take the mashkon and sell it, and then you'll have protection that way. So the fact that you're not taking the easier route, that you're trying to keep this person helped and provided for in the way they want to be, so that's where you call it a mitzvah. Others, Rashi and others, suggest, Mukhi Yosef, that maybe this is an extra chesed to the borrower, because if you use the mashkon, so then you can reduce that from the debt. So let's say you lend the guy $100, and he lends you his lawnmower, he gives you the lawnmower as the mashkon rather, so then you rent out the lawnmower, and then you say whatever you get from the rental, you'll take off the debt. So then you could rent it out for $20, now the guy only gives you $80, so you're doing another favor to this guy. So therefore it's a chesed on top of chesed, so maybe that's why it's a mitzvah. And the other Rishonim suggest that even just psychologically, that the guy feels a little bit better, that if he borrows money from you, he feels totally dependent. But if he's actually able to give you something that you can use while he's waiting, so then he feels a little bit less dependent on you, and that's a emotional chesed, and that's also something to praise. So based on these different reasons, so some of the Sfarim talk about, should you say that there is, if you give somebody a check, does that accomplish anything? Let's say, for example, so maybe you borrow money from somebody, and you'll give them a post-dated check, so that'll give them security, that they'll know that 3 months from now they can cash your check, and therefore they shouldn't worry about lending you the money now. So that accomplishes some of these goals of calling a mashkon mitzvah, and others not. So that's the whole discussion that the Svarim had. So the big topic, we only have a few minutes left, we'll finish in a minute, and we'll have a minute here, but the mitzvah of ribbis, the avera of ribbis, is also in this pasuk, and that's a huge topic. Obviously, we're not going to discuss halachas ribbis in 4 minutes, but it's just interesting, the whole yesod of the yesod ribbis, which we spoke about a little bit last year, the whole idea that taking interest on a loan is an avera, when it's actually a reasonable thing to do. You could take interest in a way that's exploitative, and you could abuse somebody by taking what's called nowadays usury, which means predatory interest. You're taking advantage of the fact that they're in need and putting on great debts, and this was why there was a financial collapse in America 5 years ago, because people took advantage of people who needed to borrow and kept piling on the debts more and more. So you could see why there's a moral issue in certain types of interest. But even just a little bit of interest, that it should be a normal rate of business, like a bank, why that should be a problem, it's not so obvious, right? That's something which the world needs to, in the business context, to function. So why is it that the Torah prohibits even a little bit of interest? So there's a lot to say about this, more than we have time for now. But I think one aspect that you find here is that the Torah is telling us That's, for example, in Parshas Bahar, where we also have the Yesurib. The Yesurib appears three times in the Torah, so it's here, and it's also in Parshas Bahar. So there, as we approach the Shemitah year, so we find this relevant as well, that it's in Parshas Bahar near the mitzvah of Shemitah. So Shemitah, we know, is about the Emunah. The mitzvahs of Zeroyim in general, we talk about the Emunah and Bitachon. And you could understand why. If someone's not going to work his field for a year, so you could see it takes a lot of Emunah to think you'll be able to function and to survive without working for a year. So we understand the connection of those mitzvahs and Emunah. But let's say somebody were to say to a Beis Din, say, listen, okay, rabbis, you don't want me to work my field? I won't. But I want you to write me a contract guaranteeing that whatever, if I fall short in my income this year, you will cover whatever loss I have by not working my field. So is that person still fulfilling the mitzvah of Shemitah? Technically, yes, but it's not very impressive in terms of bitachon. That's not really called any kind of emunah. If you say, I'll only fulfill the mitzvah if the rabbi is guaranteeing me I'll be covered. So that's not so much, that's not so impressive. So too here, if this whole context the Torah is telling us is a mitzvah to help people out of chesed when somebody needs a loan, so a person to say, okay, God, you want me to do a chesed, you want me to help this person out, I'll do it. As long as he guarantees me that I'm covered the same way in the bank. Nothing fancy. The same interest I get in the bank, he should cover that this chesed will not cost me even that much, then I'll do it. So for a person to say he's only going to engage in this chesed when he gets this kind of guarantee, that's an offense, not against the borrower. And many assume that it's actually an aver ben adam b'makom, that ribbis is actually a yerideya aver. What's the big raya that ribbis is a yerideya aver? It's in yerideya. It's not in choshen mishpat. So that maybe it's an aver ben adam b'makom, it's an offense to God. God says, I want you to do chasadim, and you say, I'm only going to do it if I'm covered. That's an offense to him. So that's all what the context of this pasuk is. This pasuk is telling us that there is a mitzvah of chesed to help out in this way. And we don't say, oh, we're only going to do it if it's guaranteed. And it's interesting, the Ramban has a comment. I should have two more things that we're done. The Ramban has a comment that one shouldn't think that the connection of the Isser Nosha being a creditor and Ribbis mentioned the same pasuk here, that they really have a similar idea to them, that both of them are saying that you should help out and just help out l'shem chesed and not l'shem anything else. And you shouldn't use this chesed of lending to get an advantage on the other guy. So ribbis is a financial advantage. We'll have to pay you for the benefit of loaning. And the nosha is a social advantage, that if you could lord it over the guy, if you now have superiority to the guy because you lent him money, so that's also not right. So the issur of nosha and the issur of ribbis are both saying the same thing, that chesed is a mitzvah, and you shouldn't use that, the lending is a chesed, and you shouldn't use this for ulterior goals of trying to have an edge over the guy, whether financial or social.
I feel like it's more common of an answer of why there's no, why we can't do ribbis is because we're supposed to look at him as if he's a close family member.
Yeah, the Avinezer says like that. Yeah, they're around the Rishonim say that also. The Avinezer says that he has a whole kuntras on ribbis, and his tshuva is called tshuvas kuntras bris achim. And bris is an anagram of ribbis, but also it highlights the idea that it's all about a covenant among brothers. And even though it's reasonable to charge normal interest, but you wouldn't do that to your brother. He's such a close relative, so you're supposed to see all the Jews in that way. It's a much longer discussion. We're out of time, but I can't resist mentioning just the last pasuk here, because it's very important hashgafically. So we talk about, there's always a question, what exactly we mean by Lefnimishur Sadin, what do we mean by Midos and Halacha? What exactly is the definition of one, the definition of the other? And it's a hard thing, example. When we talk about going Lefnimishur Sadin and the idea that Halacha might require one thing, but maybe Midos sometimes requires a little bit more, and where exactly does one start and one end is not an easy subject. We'll have to say more about it in the future. But I just want to mention that Sri Deyesha is a truth about this. And Sri Deyesha is true, so he talks about the difference between the two, about strict halacha and midos. And sometimes the issue is that the halacha is localized in one area and it only has a certain requirement, but there's other components. There's rachmanis and there's tzlaka, which tells you you have to do something else. So he brings a raya from the last pasuk of this aliyah, so we can't let our learning of this aliyah close without mentioning it, that here, this idea of the mashkon, so the pasuk says in chavol tachbol salmas riecha ad bo hashemesh teshivenu lo, that you have to give it back to him if he needs this garment to sleep in, he needs this garment to wear, it's the only garment he has, you have to give it back to him. Now, listen to this last pasuk. This is the Sri Deyesha highlights the significance of this pasuk. Very, very important idea. Kihi chsuso levada, hi simlaso leoro. Right, this is his only garment. This is what he needs to cover himself. But me yishkav, what's he going to sleep in, this guy, if you don't give it back to him? V'haya ki yitzak elai v'shamati ki chanunani. So he's going to scream out to God. He's going to say, I have nothing to wear because this guy won't give it back to me. And God says, I'll have rachmanis on him, because I'm compassionate, I'm going to have mercy on this guy. So as Rudy H. says here, this pasuk is really getting to the whole point that sometimes legally you only have a certain restricted responsibility, but there's also another component here. There's rachmanis to have. Okay, you're right, you're entitled to a mashkan, you're entitled to collateral, but this guy's got nothing to sleep in, and he's going to scream. So what are you going to do about it? So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I have rachmanis, that's the attitude that you should have as well, and that's a part of this balance that we sometimes have to take into account, a very important discussion, and we shouldn't let this pasuk pass without taking note. Okay, we will dav mincha. Sorry for going overtime. Yosef, Nadam, for us.
Yeah, okay.